Hey everyone, and welcome to At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. Ben Nicholson-Smith here with you, along with Arden Zwelling. I am back in Canada, in Toronto right now. Arden, you're still in Dunedin, Florida. How are things going? Maybe at this point you're not exactly in Dunedin, but you are in the general area of Blue Jays spring training, still grinding, still working. How are you?
I'm currently in Clearwater, so I'm Dunedin adjacent.
There we go.
Very, very near to Dunedin, and I will be in Dunedin in about an hour and a half. And then I will be in Sarasota because the Blue Jays have a rare night game tonight against the Orioles on the road. So, you know, we're taking a little tour of Florida here today.
That's what spring training is, a little tour of Florida that just keeps going and going, and lots of bus trips for the Blue Jays regulars, lots of car rides for Arden and the rest of the Sportsnet crew down there, doing a great job covering off spring training. But let's dive into the latest news here. And to me, I kind of think we have to start with Max Scherzer, who is just dealing with a thumb issue right now. He says some discomfort that he's feeling the day after he's pitching. He threw in a minor league game on Monday. We're recording this here on Tuesday, March the 18th. What do you make of where Scherzer is at? Because to me, this is one of the big looming questions for this team coming out of spring training.
Yeah, it's a lot of unknowns, I think, for him as well, because he's done a lot of work on this. Obviously, he dealt with it last year with Texas, and I think learned a lot about the nervous system. You could talk to Eric Lauer about that as well. That's somebody who's also been through like really extensive nerve issues that sapped his velocity and screwed up his mechanics and like drove him out of affiliated ball for a bit. He had to go overseas, and then just this past offseason did a whole ton of work in terms of like retracking the nerves in his arm just to be able to get his velo back and his command back, and he's feeling a lot better this spring and actually throwing the ball really well. So you can get there, but it can take a really long time to figure these things out. So I think that's why Max is a little frustrated by it right now, because this is right about the kind of build-up point where last year he experienced it, and it really ended up kiboshing the majority of his 2024. And obviously no one wants that outcome to occur again, but it's really a day-by-day thing here, to your point, depending on how he feels the day after he pitches and how his body bounces back and how his body responds. So we don't have that information right now, so it's hard to kind of put any kind of a prediction on where this is going, but this is certainly worth monitoring.
Yeah, 100% has to be, just when you think about, okay, last year he had this issue that ran from his thumb through his triceps. So that's, you know, covering a big chunk of his arm. And right now it's in the thumb, unclear exactly, you know, how connected it is, or could this extend more? They're obviously trying to stop it from becoming a bigger issue. So from that standpoint, rest makes sense. And he has built up to 50, 55 pitches somewhere in there. But the longer he's sidelined, then the longer it's going to take for him to get built back up, of course. So what's your sense of what the Blue Jays would do contingency-wise? Is it Yarbrough? Is it Yariel Rodriguez? How do you think they're preparing in a worst case where Scherzer has to start on the IL?
I think you slide Yariel Rodriguez in there for at least the first turn, and then you assess after that. And you can kind of play the matchups with this depending on who you're facing and the composition of their lineup and who's throwing well at the time. I don't think you can rule out the possibility of a bullpen day being mixed in there somewhere, as you know, crazy as it is to be talking about bullpen days in the first and second week of the season. The Blue Jays might be heading in that direction right now. But yeah, I think you identified the candidates there, Rodriguez and Yarbrough. And look, you got a righty and a lefty and two guys who throw in two very different manners with two very different approaches and two very different arsenals. So you can kind of, you have the luxury of just picking the guy who matches up best against the lineup that you're facing. And I think you just kind of match up it from there, because there isn't like an obvious option ready to step in who you're going to say, yep, like this guy, five innings every 5 days, we're going to feel good about that. Like that just doesn't exist right now.
Yeah, absolutely not. And this is where the Yarbrough signing was really important, especially when you're signing Scherzer. He's kind of like your big ticket starting pitcher acquisition. He's 40 years old. So it's not a shock that this would be something that would come up. You need to have someone like Yarbrough ready. even still, like, I look at this team and their just kind of overall composition, their overall strengths and weaknesses, and I really do look at starting pitching as probably the biggest, most important question mark for this group, because, you know, not only do you have Scherzer with the health questions, but, you know, Kevin Gausman, he's getting older. We saw his strikeout rate drop by about 10 percentage points last year. Jose Berríos had trouble finishing off batters and getting those strikeouts last year as well. Chris Bassett's getting older. Bowden Francis had an incredibly low batting average on balls in play last year. So look, these are good pitchers still. I'm not trying to be too negative here. And they're going to be supported by a very, very good defense. So that all helps. But I do see vulnerability here on this pitching staff.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that the Blue Jays are going to have to be looking at who hits waivers at the end of spring training and potentially putting in a claim or even a few claims just to see if there's someone on a non-roster deal somewhere who exercises an opt-out or, you know, asks for their release or what have you and becomes available, even just as AAA depth, really, because you're not going to have Adam Macko and Adam Klopfenstein ready to go at the beginning of the year. So when you're looking at your AAA rotation, you're looking at Jake Bloss, Eric Lauer, Andrew Bash, Lazaro Estrada, maybe CJ Van Eyck or someone, right? Like, I don't know, Trenton Wallace. Like, I'm not even sure who else would factor in there. And it's like a non-zero chance that maybe Eric Lauer's in your major league rotation. Like, we're going to watch him pitch here. It's March 18th, Tuesday. If he looks really, really good, as he has up to this point in spring training, like, maybe he's making starts for the Blue Jays early in the season, and he's not in that AAA rotation. So I think the Blue Jays are going to want to be acquiring some depth starters towards the end of spring, and that's just going to depend on who is really available in that market.
Man, that's a tough one. Eric Lauer arrived late to camp, didn't pitch in the majors last year. Year before that, had an ERA approaching 7, so we'll see if that's the answer the Blue Jays are looking for. But of course, plan A is they don't have to go there, and Scherzer's able to help them out and provide that stability once every 5 days. But, you know, it's interesting because I think we should mention, as the Blue Jays are dealing with this issue, their division rivals are also dealing with a ton of health concerns. And I think the Yankees are probably first and foremost on this front, where Clark Schmidt's dealing with a shoulder issue. Gerrit Cole's getting Tommy John. Luis Gil's missing half the season. So they're kind of in disarray. I mean, the Yankees, they might need to be at the point where they're phoning Kyle Gibson. They're, you know, trying to acquire Kenta Maeda from the Tigers. Like, these are the sorts of things that the Yankees probably need to be doing right now. The Red Sox as well have some starters who are, you know, between Brian Bello, Cutter Crawford, guys who are dealing with some injuries, and of course the Orioles with Grayson Rodriguez. So this entire division, which looks to be super competitive, is really going to be shaped by health, which is always the case, but we're already seeing that really early in spring training. And to me, this actually kind of changes the dynamic of the entire divisional race.
Well, yeah, when you're a Blue Jays fan, you've been watching nothing but Jose Berríos, Kevin Gausman, Chris Bassett, and Yusei Kikuchi just making start after start after start for the last 2 years and never hitting the IL. It's easy to forget that 29 other teams are constantly scrambling for pitching and constantly dealing with injuries to starters and injuries in their bullpen and, like, constantly churning guys through waivers and having guys on the optionable carousel up and down from AAA. So what the Blue Jays are going through here with Eric Swanson not available for the beginning of the season, Max Scherzer's status in question, this isn't, like, exceptional. This isn't strange. This should be expected entering a major league season. And, you know, really, when you've got a rotation built on, you know, a 34-year-old Kevin Gausman and a 36-year-old Chris Bassett and a 40-year-old Max Scherzer, you have to actually just enter the season believing that at some point you're going to encounter situations like this repeatedly.
As long as we're looking at the pitching staff here, I want to get your sense of where things stand in the bullpen. And we did see the Blue Jays select the contract of Richard Lovelady the other day. That puts him on the 40-man roster. That's a clear sign that he's got a very, very good chance to make the opening day roster, along with, of course, your Jeff Hoffman, your Chad Green, Jimmy Garcia, Sandlin, Yariel Rodriguez, if he's not needed in the rotation. Swanson, as you mentioned, certain to start the season on the injured list. Who else do you see kind of working their way into that bullpen at this point?
Zach Pop and Tommy Nance as the added options guys have a leg up because they're out of options. Honestly, like that's just the reality of it. And look, you're not trying to build your best 26 for one day of the season. You're trying to build your best 40 for 6 months of a season. So particularly when it comes to relievers towards the end of camp, I think that optionality is massive and typically like the deciding factor there. So like I would give those two the edge over anybody that does have options. Dylan Tate on a major league deal does have an option. So I would say likely he starts at AAA as the Blue Jays just seek to preserve flexibility. You can say the same of Josh Walker and Nick Robertson and certainly Easton Lucas as guys that, you know, are on the 40 but have options and likely begin the year at AAA.
Yeah, I think that's a good read. That makes a lot of sense. And, you know, to me, I actually think it makes sense. You take the guys who are out of options, you preserve your depth. It's this roster will be changing probably by the end of March. Like they won't even make it to April without making a roster move. They're going to be making moves even, you know, after that first series with Baltimore, during that first series with Baltimore, it always happens. So to have those extra arms around makes a lot of sense. But, you know, one thing I've been kind of wondering here as spring training has unfolded on the pitching side for the Blue Jays is, you know, just do they have enough velocity? And this is a point that Nick Ashbourne made in conversation with me the other day, and it got me thinking a little bit. But looking at the Blue Jays spring training numbers, they've thrown as a team, as a collective, they've thrown 14 pitches at 97 miles an hour or harder. And it's just not very much. I mean, they're individual pitchers who, you know, might throw that in the course of one dominant start. If it's a Hunter Green, if it's a Jackson Job, you know, there are guys who do that. And again, the Blue Jays are an older staff. They have more savvy. They have more pitchability. They have other things that they do well as a group. But velocity is really important. When you're looking at this staff, do you think that there's enough velocity to be found here?
Are you thinking just bullpen or are you including the starters as well?
I would include the starting rotation. I mean, it's probably more of a bullpen concern where Jimmy Garcia, he's kind of been the guy. Jeff Hoffman has four pitches, you know, that have clocked 97 or above. We know Hoffman gets great swing and miss with his fastball. It's still a really good fastball because of the way he uses it and the extension he has. But yeah, I would say mostly bullpen.
Yeah, I agree because in the rotation, Kevin Gausman's the one guy who, like, I've had an eye on the velo this spring, and the velo has actually looked really good for him. So, like, to me, that's written off any concerns there. I have zero concerns about Jose Berríos in terms of his stuff and his physicality. Chris Bassett just, like, is not throwing as hard right now as he could because that's just how he gets ready for a season. And I think you could say the same of Max Scherzer, too, when he was on the mound. So, I mean, those two guys, I'm not too worried about the velo. And, like, Bassett, not a guy who relies on velo, a guy who relies on eight different pitches, seven of them in service, really, of setting up his sinker. You know, Max Scherzer, a guy who locates as well as anybody to the edges and tunnels as well as anybody. Like, his control and command is exceptional. And he's also still shown an ability to get up to 93, occasionally 94 at the age of 40, turning 41. So no concerns there. And Bowden Francis, a guy who showed last year, like he can get results when he doesn't have his best velo. Obviously he's better when he's 95, 96, but you know, on days when he's 92, 93, like he can mix in more of his splitter and he can, you know, hone in a bit more on command and move up and down and in and out and, you know, flip in first pitch curveballs for strikes. So he's shown at least that he's developed a bit of an ability to get by when he doesn't have his peak velo. In the bullpen, as you said, no concerns about Jeff Hoffman and Jimmy Garcia when it comes to velo. Chad Green isn't a guy who's like blowing it by you at the best of times. Nick Sandlin, similarly, you know, he's probably going to throw his splitter more than any other pitch in the first month of the season, I would bet. The Blue Jays want him using it more often against righties, and he's already using it a hell of a lot against lefties. So not a guy who's dependent on velocity. Zach Pop's still throwing hard. That's what he does. I think Richard Lovelady has kind of a sneaky fastball. Like, his velo can kind of surprise you a little bit, but also a guy who obviously is reliant on really good slider. And Tommy Nance is like, his whole thing is, I have this outlier curveball that I throw, you know, nobody throws a curveball this hard with this much movement in baseball. And that's why it, you know, does so well in pitch modeling and Stuff Plus and some of these tools that we have to analyze things on a per pitch basis. And Yariel Rodriguez, we've seen him up to 95, 96, 97. So I just don't think that the composition of this pitching staff is one where you should be expecting to see a lot of 98s and 99s. That's just not what they've built.
Yes, agreed 100%. It's not like these guys are performing below where they should. Individual to individual, they're doing what they should. That makes sense. I think it's more when I look at the collective and you look at the results here, it's kind of like, oh, there's not really a lot of, you know, just pure overpowering gas. Now, we all know from watching Nate Pearson and countless other pitchers, velocity on its own is not enough. It's not a velocity competition. It is a challenge of keeping hitters off balance, whatever that looks like. So velocity is one tool in doing that. It's not the only tool, but I would say it's probably the most important tool, arguably with, you know, command. But having an overpowering fastball or two out of the bullpen, I think, would make this team a lot better. And look, if they're in a position at the end of camp, which they always are, and they're, you know, maybe making a waiver claim or two to kind of shuffle things around as those 40-man spots are solidifying for the final time, finding someone who does have velocity, that could be a nice addition to this group.
Hey, if Yenesis Cabrera doesn't make the bats out of camp, bring him back.
That would be amazing.
And I'm being 100% earnest. Sign me up for 65 more appearances of that, because the most entertaining guy to watch on the staff last year by far.
So John Schneider calling on the left-handed reliever Yenesis Cabrera to try and get him out of a jam. Swing and a miss, strike three. Got him on the cutter, back-to-back strikeouts for Cabrera. Bouncing ball hits softly to third. Charging in, Barger to first, and the splits by Guerrero to end the inning. Yenesis Cabrera comes on with the bases loaded. Nobody out, only allows one.
Some people critique the Blue Jays offseason for not getting Vlad Jr. done. Here on At the Letters, we critique the Blue Jays offseason for not finding a way to bring Yenesis Cabrera back. Number 92 needed an extension here. But
you want velo, you want stuff? Like, that guy had incredible and has incredible stuff.
That's right. Well, sending our best to Yenesis Cabrera here on At the Letters. But before we step away for a quick break, you know, as long as we're talking run prevention here, Arden, I want to get your read on Dalton Varsho, because he's as important as any non-pitcher on this team when it comes to keeping runs off the board. And reading some of the reporting the other day, it sounds as though the lean at this point is to start Varsho on the injured list and let him recover for a bit, as opposed to DHing out of the gate. Am I getting that? Is that your read on things as well?
Yeah, I think that's the sensible thing to do. Again, it's the what's your best 40 for 6 months. It's not what's your best 26 for one day. And if you rush it with this recovery from the shoulder issue, from shoulder surgery, I should say, if you put him in a position where he's 80% ready but not quite there, and then he has a setback or aggravates something early in the season, like, these are the sort of things that could set him back months. These are the sort of things that could ruin half a season for the guy. So to me, it's just not worth the risk. Like, to me, I think you want to get this rehab and recovery right. He's already ahead of schedule, so credit to him. Like, he's been working incredibly hard, and I mean, the other day he was out there at like 120 feet and the Blue Jays have a radar gun on him, like, while he's doing these throws, like, recording his velocity, because they're trying to see, like, how close he's getting to the arm strength he had last season, because they're trying to let data drive this process. They're trying to use measurables and not just use, yeah, that one felt good, and yeah, that one didn't look good, or yeah, that one looked hard, or that one didn't look firm. This is, like, very much, what can we measure? What is your baseline? What is your standard? How are you bouncing back the next day? Like, what, you know, when we work out on back-to-back days, how does that impact your strength? Because once you're into the rigors of an MLB season, like, it just is what it is. You got to play day games after night games, and you got to play in the third city of a long road trip, and you're in a different time zone, and you didn't sleep well, and, you know, you took a swing the night before that, you know, something didn't feel great. Like, you got to grind through that stuff. So I think you want to put Dalton Varsho in the best possible physical position to help this team over 6 months, not just on opening day as a DH only. If it's me, I'm not carrying Dalton Varsho as a DH only. That, I just don't think that makes sense for your entire 26, and I don't think that makes sense for 6 months.
And I think too, I agree with the analysis there. And I think like when you're talking about him as a potential DH, this is a time where it's worth remembering that spring training is small samples. Because look, he's had a great spring training. He's connected on a lot of, I think, 4 home runs to this point in spring. He's looking really good at the plate. At the same time, let's not let that overshadow what we've seen from him in the course of his entire career. And in his entire career, we're talking about a 97 OPS plus player, which is perfectly respectable. It's great if you happen to be an elite center fielder as well. But as a DH, you don't have to reconstruct your whole offense around a guy who's essentially a league average hitter. There are other ways to accomplish that and other ways to let other players, you know, prove themselves, not prove themselves, get that offense in the mix and let Dalton Varsho recover. So I don't think that you need to like shoehorn him in here. It's not like you have, obviously, if it was Vlad Jr. and he couldn't throw, he's DHing. Like, it's not a question. But I think when you're talking about the kind of offensive profile that he offers, you don't have to be quite that aggressive.
Well, he's not being pitched the way he'll be pitched in the regular season right now, because he's facing guys who are working on stuff. He's facing guys who haven't like pored over his scouting report and aren't, you know, it's not like a must win game. It's not a regular season game that counts. So they're not saying, all right, I need to do what I need to do to get Dalton Varsho out. You're facing guys that just aren't bringing that level of preparation and execution to it. So like kudos, it's not taking anything away from him. Like kudos to him for hitting like 4 rockets out of, you know, the ballparks down here. But I think that if you took the overall like quality of pitcher that he's faced this spring, from the big leaguers that he's faced to the minor leaguers, like the A ball pitchers that he's faced, like he's probably faced, you know, a good double A pitcher or like an average triple A pitcher in terms of like his 28 plate appearances this spring or whatever it is. So I don't think it's worthwhile putting too much, as you said, into the spring training results, because there's a million other variables that are playing into those. But we don't even have to go that far, because the Blue Jays start with 20 games in 21 days, and they're going to need that DH spot for George Springer and for Anthony Santander and for Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and for whoever else like picks up a little bump or a bruise early in the season and needs a couple days off their feet but can still go to the plate and hit for you. Like I promise you, you know, the Blue Jays open with what, 7 at Rogers Center, I think. Mm-hmm. I promise you Anthony Santander is not even playing 5 of those in the field. You're not going to have him running around on turf every single day. So yeah, you need that DH spot.
Yeah, for sure. To your point on quality of competition, this is measured on Baseball Reference. Dalton Varsho, to this point in spring, his opponent quality is that of essentially double A. So confirmed, Dalton Varsho can hit double A pitching. That is great. That is what you want to see. He's doing what he should against it. Yeah, there are further tests ahead, so no need to rush that process. All right, well, with that, let's step away here on At the Letters, presented by MLB The Show 25. When we come back, more to come on the Toronto Blue Jays, plus a new segment coming your way. Baseball is back. This episode of At the Letters is presented by MLB The Show 25. Ignite your passion and build your very own path to greatness. Customize your journey in MLB The Show 25 with the newly revamped Road to the Show's 99 progression system and build your baseball dreams from high school to the Hall of Fame. It's your very own Road to the Show. Forge your baseball journey in MLB The Show 25, rated E for everyone. Visit theshow.com. Available on PlayStation 5, Nintendo Switch, and Xbox Series X and S. Welcome back to At the Letters, and it is time now for a new segment, the Decision of the Week, presented by MLB The Show 25. How will your journey evolve? Arden, what we're going to do on this segment is discuss one of the big decisions facing the Blue Jays, and there is certainly no shortage really at any time of year. One of the kind of wild things about baseball is there's just constantly decisions being made. So this week, the one that I want to throw at you as we introduce this segment is, how do the Blue Jays complete, round out, really decide on what their bench is going to be? We talked a little bit about Dalton Varsho, how he is not likely to be breaking camp with this team. That does open up a spot. So how do you see things unfolding here for the Jays?
So if we rule out Varsho, so it's just, let's put him on the IL for this exercise. And let's work our way around a starting lineup just to rule those individuals out. So at catcher, you're going to have Alejandro Kirk. At first base, you got Vlad. At second, you got Jimenez. At short, you got Bo Bichette. At third base, I'm going to put Ernie Clement in there. He's on this team, so let's just like put him there just for the sake of this exercise. Santander in left. Let's leave center open. We'll put Springer in right, and let's have Will Wagner DH. Mm-hmm. So we've left center field open, and then we got four bench spots. Let's eliminate one bench spot with the backup catcher. To me, it's Tyler Heineman. Do you disagree?
I actually agree. I think that he's the likeliest, but yeah, let's leave that there. Let's go with Heineman.
All right, so now we are left with center field and three bench spots. I think one of the bench spots was essentially between Aurelvis Martinez and Davis Schneider as like a right-handed power bat. Not the best defensive fit in either case, but Schneider obviously gives you more. Just he could play a corner outfield. He could play second, although you don't need a second baseman with Jimenez playing every inning. Schneider, you could throw him at third here and there. I just think with the way things have gone this spring and with the major league experience of the two, Davis Schneider is that guy in that bench spot over Elvis Martinez. You tracking with that? That sound good to you?
I agree. I think that they're not going to Elvis. They're going to Schneider.
Okay. So now we've got center field and two bench spots. And with Varsho off the roster, you definitely need one outfielder and you probably need two. And then you got another spot to work with.
Yeah, so I think you need two outfielders.
Yeah, you need two outfielders. And then the other spot, you probably want at least somebody who's capable of playing infield in case you're moving things around, pinch hitting, in case Bo Bichette takes a ball off his finger, whatever.
Yeah, you don't want to lose the DH by putting Will Wagner in the field.
Exactly. So let's handle that one infield spot then. To me, it's Addison Barger or Leo Jimenez.
Yeah.
Barger brings more offensive upside, obviously, like can hit the ball really, really hard from the left side of the plate. Leo brings more defensive upside, just in terms of you can throw him at shortstop, you can throw him anywhere in the infield. He's super competent defensively. Barger just not as good defensively, although he does have like the corner outfield ability. Which gives him, makes him a bit more dynamic, I guess, than Leo. But to me, it's basically like, do you want the offensive Barger or the defensive Leo? And to me, with Ernie Clement on the roster and capable of covering at shortstop, I'm going with the offense of Barger, who can play third base or an outfield corner.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I'm with you. I do have one question about Barger, but I'm with you on the decision there.
Okay. So then we're down to two spots and we need two outfielders. So I would say you've got six candidates. You've got Miles Straw, Joey Loperfido, Nathan Lucas, Alan Roden, Jonathan Class A, Stuart Baroa. And I'm willing to even cut that down to just four by putting Jonathan Class A and Stuart Baroa at AAA.
Did you say Alan Roden?
I did. We're going to put Class A and Baroa at AAA. We got two bench spots, two outfielders between Loperfido, Lucas, Roden, and Straw.
Yep.
And personally, like, I would be good with any combination of the above. I do wonder if the Blue Jays want to platoon it and go right left, which assures Straw one of the spots because he's the only righty of the bunch. Roden, Lucas, and Loperfido all lefties. So that's one like option is you go definitely Straw and then one of Roden, Lucas, Loperfido. You could go Loperfido, Lucas, and like Straw and Roden aren't on the 40 currently, and maybe you want to preserve flexibility, and you don't want to have to open up a spot. So maybe you just go with the two guys who are on the 40 and see how that goes. You could say Alan Roden's had like a tremendous camp and has earned it, and we really need the offensive upside. And of those four, like, Roden is probably bringing you the most offense right now.
Yeah.
You could go that way. You could say that, like, without Dalton Varsho on the roster, we really need to prioritize defense. Like, we really need good center field defense, in which case Miles Straw has to be one of them because of Straw, Roden, Lucas, Loperfido. He's your best center field defender, and I think Lucas is probably your number two of that bunch. So
Like, it really depends on what you value, what you need, who you're facing in the first week of the season, who picks up like a little bumper bruise between now and opening day. Like, I think that all those factors play in, but I think you can make a pretty strong case, a pretty justifiable case, honestly, for any two of Lo Perfetto, Lucas, Roden, Straw.
That's a compelling argument. I think that certainly if 40-man space is at a premium and you just can't afford to select someone else's contract, then, you could certainly go with Lucas and Lo Perfetto. You're not adding anyone to the 40-man. You're good to go in that situation. Now, I kind of think that defense for a full season, of course, like, you need Dalton Varsho out there. He's an incredible addition to this team. For 10 days, for 2 weeks, how many balls are going to be hit right on the edge of an outfielder's ability where, you know, an elite defender makes the play, but an average outfielder doesn't make the play? It might be one or two, right? It might actually not be that many baseballs that are hit into the gaps right where you're at the edge of someone's ability. So, you know, given that, I would be tempted to take Alan Roden. If you do have the 40-man space, that's something that I would be very, very open to if I was the Blue Jays. I mean, there are a lot of factors to be determined between now and then. So I'm not saying like you have to take him at all costs, but that's something that I would be very open to because the offensive upside that he offers is actually pretty decent. So, you know, I think that that's an intriguing possibility at a time that Straw is not giving you anything offensively. You kind of know what Nathan Lucas is giving you. And Lo Perfetto, he's promising, but he's not hitting the way Alan Roden is right now.
I think the counter to your argument would be that it only takes one or two catchable balls not caught to allow a couple of runners to score, to sacrifice a lead, to extend an inning, to force you to use another reliever, to lose a game. There are knock-on consequences for that. It's not just one ball gets through and that's the end of, you know, the poor consequences from that happening. This could be the difference between a win and a loss. This could be the difference between Chris Bassett throwing 95 pitches in an outing and throwing 105 pitches in an outing. This could be the difference in using Nick Sandlin 3 out of 4 or only using him 2 out of 4. So these are things that like do bleed over and carry over and do like make you worse in future games in ways that are hard to quantify.
Yeah. And not to overlook that, because that's real. I do think at the same time, Miles Straw, realistically, he's just not giving you a lot offensively. So you could say the same thing about offensively where, okay, Roden comes up, he hits a gapper, you know, where Straw might have popped out. All of a sudden you have a 3-run rally. The entire complexion of a game is different. So, you know, that's the trade-off that you're making. And of course, there are developmental considerations with Alan Roden because you don't want him to stagnate. But, you know, I think that at the same time, you probably could make a case that there is development to be had at the major league level and that he could learn a lot from being in the major leagues. He's a guy who gets the most out of the resources that are around him. He's a guy who would get a lot out of talking to coaches and being in that major league environment. He's not getting 4 ABs a night, but guess what? The Jays have a traject machine. He can step in there and he can stay relatively fresh. I know it's not the same, but you know, I think that you need to be considering the development of these guys. You need to be considering the 40-man roster. So there's really a lot that goes into it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, Alan Roden's had a really good spring training. He's been very impressive at the plate. But using the Baseball Reference opposition quality that you referred to earlier, he's at a 7.1, which is the exact same as Dalton Varsho. Yeah. And we wrote off Dalton Varsho's really strong spring because of opponent quality. So we kind of have to do the same for Alan Roden if we're being consistent here. So we can't really factor in how well he's hit this spring. So you really do have to have like a better way of evaluating his readiness to hit big league pitching. And whether he's, you know, how he would respond to the pressure of coming up for the first month and having to take some really big at bats and really big spots, right? Like, and just like, you never know until you put a guy into that scenario, but not everybody responds to it the same.
That's right. And yeah, no question. Big league pitching is incredibly tough and it will be an adjustment for any player, including him, when he comes up at some point this season. But yeah, I think that, you know, it's a good time for the Jays to be open-minded on all these guys, as you said, because there is legitimately a case to be made for many different configurations here. My one question for you before we step away, unless you have anything else to add on the bench here.
Well, did you offer which direction you would go in?
I don't have like a hard take right now because I think it depends too. Like, let's say there's a really good catcher on waivers that you want to claim. Mm-hmm. Claim the catcher. Boom, there's your 40-man spot. All right, you have to roll with Lucas and Loperfido because you don't want to select someone else to the 40-man. Fine, take the catching depth. Same with relief pitching. Same with if there's like, you know, a really good swing man on waivers, you can get him, add him to the staff. Maybe you DFA Zach Pop. Okay, well, there's your 40-man spot. But, you know, the point being, I don't really feel so compelled by any one of these players that I feel like you have to set other considerations aside.
That was absolutely my point, is if like a Carlos Carrasco or a Chris Flexen or somebody or Ross Stripling like becomes available at the end of camp, and but like to you know, bring them in as starting pitching depth, you got to add them to the 40. I'm strongly considering that and not adding a Roden or a Straw. And going with Loperfido and Lucas. Like, I think that would tip me in that direction. If I had the 40-man spot, honestly, I would do the less fun thing and take Straw and Lucas and have Joey Loperfido play center field every day in AAA and Alan Roden play right field every day in AAA.
Yeah. If there was 40-man flexibility, I would take Lucas and Roden. And I would have Lucas playing center field, split with Roden, you know, depending on matchups. I would try Roden out there and see. And, you know, I would tell him from the outset, this is, you're probably going to go back to AAA. Don't put too much pressure on yourself. You're here to help the team for a couple weeks. Do what you can and get the most out of this experience and see what happens.
Who's playing center field against lefties in that scenario?
I mean, the Blue Jays don't have a good option for someone to play center field against lefties, because you could tell me that Miles Straw, okay, he has the platoon advantage, but he's still Miles Straw. So, I just don't see among these four a good option offensively.
I think that the other point in Miles Straw's favor is the difference he makes on the base paths. Constelia base could be a valuable pinch runner late in games. Also has the bunting ability that we haven't seen from an Alan Roden. So if you're in a spot late in the game where you needed a bunt down, you needed, if Straw's hitting ninth and, Will Wagner or Ernie Clement are hitting seventh and eighth and those two guys reach and you need a bunt to get down, Miles Straw could do that. I know I'm like picking out very isolated, small scale scenarios here, but these are things the Blue Jays will discuss. Like these are things they will consider in making this decision.
Well, pinch running is real too, because they have Kirk on this team. So if Kirk is the tying run and he's at second base, yeah, you need a pinch runner.
If Santander is DHing and he reaches late in the game, you're probably running for him.
I guess so.
In a game where you're trailing by a run and it's the ninth inning and you really need to score that run.
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know if you're pinch running for Santander, but certainly for Kirk, maybe for, Heinemann, there is value is the point, regardless of exactly, what scenarios they would do it.
I mean, Anthony Santander, 18th percentile sprint speed last year. So if I really need somebody to move on the bases late in a game and Santander walks lead off an inning and I'm down a run, I'm probably pinch running for him. And I think the Blue Jays probably are too.
Well, I think the analytics would say to do that, but do you think that John Schneider is going to take Anthony Santander out of a game? I don't know.
Because if you don't, you might lose the game. So you got to do everything you can to tie or win that game.
I agree, but you could make the same case for, a lot of guys, right? Like Freddie Freeman, he's slow. Are you really pinch running for Freddie Freeman all the time? Are you pinch running for, Juan Soto, who's not very fast, Vlad Jr.? Like at a certain point, you just get to an offensive level that these guys don't get pinch run for very often.
Vlad has sneaky speed, and you make that point often. And like, if you're like Alejandro Kirk is tremendously valuable defensively, he catches literally every pitch and also has like a bat that you would want to keep in the lineup late in the game because of obviously his contact ability, but also his ability to hit one to the wall or even above it.
Yeah. I mean, look, it's certainly possible. I see the case for it. Like, I wouldn't sit here and say it's a bad idea if Santander's being pinch run for by Miles Straw, because I like using the bench. I'm just saying I'm not going to predict that John Schneider actually does that. I think that's a little bit of a tougher sell. We'll see. There's a lot of time to go before we even get to that bench configuration.
Where else do you hear this level of consideration of an incredibly unlikely scenario that could potentially impact your decision of who to carry on the opening day roster?
That's right. That's what you get here on At the Letters. That's what you get here on the Decision of the Week. That was brought to you by MLB The Show 25.
Can be a damaged guy down in the order. I think it'd be very, very valuable.
Speaking of damage, Guerrero sends it out to center field, and the Blue Jays have gone back to back. Pick the deepest part of the yard and the highest wall. It doesn't matter for Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
Look, the last like four episodes have been dominated by discussion about Vlad Guerrero Jr. We didn't want to do that this time, but I do want to at least acknowledge and touch on the latest developments that have occurred since we last recorded here. And specifically, there's been reporting from Joel Sherman, John Heyman, Ken Rosenthal about the specific nature of the ask from Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to the Blue Jays, the reporting being that Vladimir Guerrero Jr. sought $500 million in net present value from the Blue Jays. So we've discussed this before. I think people are probably not going to be too shocked to hear me say that I think that, you know, based on the number crunching, the conversations that I've had, looking at, you know, how Vladdy might project, looking at the projected cost of a win moving forward, and just understanding where the Blue Jays are at trying to win as an organization, I would have done that. And I think that could have been a reasonable deal. Arden, any thoughts from you, any reaction to you on these developments?
Didn't shift my perspective or my opinion on it. Which I think I have thoroughly articulated, as you said, on our last three episodes. So I don't feel any differently about the Blue Jays for holding strong to their valuation. I don't feel any differently about Vladimir Guerrero Jr. for believing in his value or where he has assessed his value. It's very interesting, and it's a really big bet, a really big wager that Vlad's putting on himself. This is somebody with a ton of self-confidence and a ton of self-belief, as you would expect from like an elite performer at the height of his field. And it's going to be if they don't come to an agreement prior to opening day, which is still possible. But if they don't, it's going to be just fascinating to see how this season plays out for Vladdy.
Yeah, truly. And yeah, I mean, I understand the idea of having a limit, and the Blue Jays pushed themselves. They got to, you know, a point where they were beyond their valuation, according to Mark Shapiro, of Vlad Jr., made what seems to be an offer around $450 million, according to our colleague Shai Davidi and his reporting. So $450 is a good offer, as we had kind of suspected. It wasn't an insulting offer. That's a strong offer. Vlad Jr. wanted more. I think that he's justified in wanting more. Now we'll see how that plays out. So, you know, very interesting sequence of events there. And you mentioned that little window, right? Because there is technically time. There are 3 days next week, 24, 5, and 6 before the season opens. Do you see like a real pathway there to something getting done? Like, what's your read on where this leads before opening day?
Well, like if you're Vlad right now, you can't come back and take 450, because then what was all this fuss about? Mm-hmm. And if you're the Blue Jays, you can't come back and just give them 500, because that just makes you look weak. And that broadcasts to every agent in the industry, like, hey, if you put public pressure on us, we'll cave. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, when we say last and best, it doesn't actually mean that. Hey, we won't actually stick to our walkaways like we say that we do. So neither side can just cave to the other. I think you could meet in the middle at 475 and tell people that you both compromised and still maintain your negotiating power in the future, or just like arrive at an entirely different structure, valuation, opt-outs, deferrals, options, etc. Whatever else you have to do to make the thing you arrive at different enough from what's been reported, so that it doesn't seem like either side moved too far off their position, or both sides moved equally off their positions.
Yes. Yeah. Something like 475. I mean, I certainly think that could be a win-win. Vlad Jr. is risking a lot by not having a substantial guarantee that the Blue Jays offered him. So I certainly think there are pathways in theory to a win-win deal. In practice, I think it is a lot harder, as you said. I mean, it's kind of interesting because if the Blue Jays offered Vlad Jr. $500 million right now, he kind of has to take it. Like,
yeah,
you know what I mean? He can't not. Like, he said, hey, he hasn't said this directly, but indirectly, he has said, yes, this is what I'm looking for, $500 million. So if the Blue Jays were hypothetically to say, here we go, that's kind of the only option he has, or else his credibility is completely gone. Now, for the reasons that you explained, I don't think the Blue Jays are just going to budge, you know, the full 50, because at that point they do undermine their own negotiating. Now, could you say, hey, this is worth it, this is a exceptional circumstance, they should do it anyway, you know, this isn't going to impact their ability to sign some pitcher on a one-year deal next winter or sign Yandy Diaz or whatever. Like, you can still do those medium small scale deals, this isn't going to change things. But I actually do think there's something to your point there, that you don't want to completely undermine yourself and contradict yourself. So I do think there's something there. But you know, a couple people have said to me, as this thing is unfolded, Vlad Jr. is still negotiating. By putting these numbers out there, if it did come through his camp, then that certainly seems to be an indication of, hey, this conversation isn't quite done. Like, maybe there's a little bit of room, but I still don't think, if I had to guess, I'm not holding my breath that a deal is going to get done next week, or even that negotiations will begin, because I just wonder, how would that conversation start? Who's phoning who? And I have a hard time seeing the resumption of that negotiation. I just don't know who's picking up the phone, kind of tail between the legs, and starting this thing.
The Blue Jays can't go a penny beyond 475 at this point. Because, like, and I don't care who you're negotiating with in the future. Like, I don't care if it's Tyler Heineman or it's Kyle Tucker. Like, their representative is going to say, well, like, when it came down to negotiate with Vlad, you know, when you said it was last and best, it wasn't actually. So the only way to get away with it is by saying, look, this was a compromise when we were $50 million apart, so we met in the middle. If you offer him $500 million right now, like, you just do not have integrity in future negotiations. You are not being consistent with what you say and how you behave. Like, you just can't do that as an organization, because the Blue Jays are going to want to sign really, really good players again in the future with really good agents and really good representatives and a lot of leverage. So there's just really no way the Blue Jays can do that. This isn't just about Vlad. This is about them as an organization. I still think the likeliest outcome in this is that Vlad plays out the season, does whatever he does, like, puts up whatever numbers he puts up, is as healthy as he is healthy, and goes into the market. And then the market makes this really black and white. It's, hey, I can go out and get X somewhere else. Can you give me X plus one? Like, that will settle all of this, because we're still dealing with theoreticals here. He's still a year away from being able to gauge what that market is. We're 9 months out from knowing, like, just what other market factors are going to be at play in terms of other teams, in terms of what's happening in the industry, in terms of broadcast situations. Like, there's so many variables that are out of the Blue Jays' control and Vlad's control in terms of what he'll be able to garner in the market next year. So maybe ultimately these two sides just need the market to clarify this for them and to say, you know what, like, the Jays think this is the value, Vlad thinks that's the value. Well, the market says this is the value, and that is definitive. And then that makes this thing pretty easy from there.
Yeah. And I hate to say it, but I mean, you look at the history of this negotiation, and we can point fingers, or we can have a discussion as to how this has unfolded or whether it should have unfolded this way. But if you look at the history, this has not been a combination between the Blue Jays and Vladdy's representation that has been able to align on a deal when they talked about it after 2021. When they talked about it later, when they talked about it early this offseason, when they talked about it later this offseason, when they went to arbitration in 2024, like, there are more instances of these sides not seeing eye to eye than there are of these sides seeing eye to eye. Now, it only takes one time to sit down at the table and have a really productive discussion. And for the sake of Blue Jays fans, I hope it happens. But I look at the history here and it doesn't scream they're definitely getting something done. And so I don't anticipate that something's going to get done. I anticipate that the most likely situation is Vlad Jr. hits free agency, and test the open market. And that, you know, that's my expectation.
And I think that the Blue Jays made Vlad a fair offer at 150 after 2021, considering the comps of Bregman and Alvarez. I think they made him a fair offer earlier this winter pre-Soto at 340, considering the comps of Devers and Harper. And I think they made him a very fair offer 2 weeks ago, or whenever this all took place, at 450, which would have been the third largest deal in baseball history, depending on where you put like the NPV of Shohei Ohtani's contract, possibly the second largest deal in baseball history, by far the largest for a first baseman, like blows out of the water all precedent in terms of AAV and total value for a first baseman, like record setting from a Blue Jays perspective, obviously. But on the other hand, I don't fault Vlad for betting on himself, right? And for believing in his ability to go out this year and have like a 950 OPS and play 160 games and hit 40 homers and go into free agency and get $600 million, right? Like, I don't fault him for gambling on himself, considering he's already got like $70 million in the bank from his career. And considering, you know, having seen the way that Aaron Judge bet on himself and made himself a whole bunch more money, and Juan Soto did the same, right? Because Vlad is in that echelon of hitter who has the ability to go out and like have a 6-7 win season in 2025. Like, that is possible for him, and it is not possible for many individuals. So if anyone's going to bet on themselves, like Vlad should, particularly with age on his side at this point. If he had to take a Billow deal, he could just re-enter free agency after his age 27 season and still do really, really well. So like, I really don't fault either side for their positions and how they've kind of played their hands here. I think to your point, they just, for a million different reasons, haven't lined up in that sweet spot that it would have taken to get a deal done.
For sure. You know, 450, definitely a strong offer. I mean, you can't say otherwise. It's a strong offer. It's a reasonable offer. You know, at the same time, they don't have Vlad Jr. beyond the next 162 games. And this is a guy who's 25 years old, turning 26. Maybe he is 26 now, actually. But he's a young player. And you look at the bat speed metrics. He swings as hard as anyone. He hits the ball as hard as anyone. This is just, he's an incredibly gifted athlete and player. You want him on your team. And so I would have gone to 500. We've discussed that at length. Didn't happen. I'm not saying the Blue Jays are unreasonable, but it's going to be super interesting.
You have to have a walkaway. Like, you have to be principled.
Yeah,
like, you
can't, I agree.
You know, we're not going to sit here and be flippant with...
Mine just would have been higher. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. But we can't sit here and be flippant with, oh, just give him the extra $50 million. Like, that's $50 million. Like, I know it's not your money, but that's someone's money. And you need to make a justification for why they're going to chip in an extra $50 million on top of the $450 million. Like, you need to make that recommendation to, like, a board of very intelligent, wealthy people, and you need to have data behind it. Like, you need to have evidence behind it. And I think it would have been very hard to do that. I think the Blue Jays already stretched themselves in recommending $450. To your point, if the Blue Jays don't sign Vladimir Guerrero Jr., they're not going to have Vladimir Guerrero Jr., but they had him for the last 6 years, and how many World Series rings do they have? How many playoff wins do they have? You can win a World Series without Vladimir Guerrero Jr.
No doubt, no doubt. I think that you do have to have a walkaway, of course. You have to back up your opinions with numbers, you know, when you're talking to an ownership group who has employed you to do exactly that. I just think that there were justifications for doing that. When you look at how rare this production is, when you look at, you know, just the fact that he's already had 2 6 war seasons, you project him forward starting at, you know, 4.5, 5 wins. You keep that going through his early 30s, let alone his mid 30s. And you're getting so much value, plus playoff value, plus playoff revenue, which is something that ownership would care about. Because, you know, more playoff games are a great thing for this franchise and for this team, but there are other ways to do it. I'm not saying Vlad Jr. is the only way to do it, but, yeah, it's very interesting. I mean, we've probably said our piece on this a few times now, so, feel free to go back and listen to those episodes, but
I think you can make a case on either side, right? Like, there's nothing wrong with your case.
And there's also nothing wrong with saying, well, how about the cautionary tales of Prince Fielder or Mark Teixeira, or, you know, pick your other, like, you know, first baseman who was incredibly productive and healthy over their first X number of seasons and then hit the age of 30 and things changed in a massive way. So you can make, a justifiable case on either side, and that's why it has been an interesting debate.
Let's leave it there and turn to another veteran Blue Jays slugger. Arden, I want to get your thoughts on what we've been seeing from George Springer.
Springer with a liner, and that one's a fair ball rolling into the corner. Barroa in to score. Guerrero getting the wave, and the Blue Jays are up to double digits on a two-run double from Springer.
You know, a player at this point who is 35 years old, and so no one's expecting him to be peak George Springer. But in spring training, this is a guy who has one extra base hit, despite the fact that he's facing double-A pitching. I don't want to be too, you know, reckless and reading into a small sample. But, you know, it'd be a little easier to rest your head on the pillow if he was having the kind of spring that Dalton Varsho and Alan Rodon are having at the plate. So what do you make of Springer? Let's just say for the first four or five weeks of the season, what is a realistic expectation for him?
I don't know. I don't like to make it that small, because players can have bad months. Players can have a poor 5 weeks and then follow it up with a really, really strong 5 weeks. So, like, you could ask, what's a good middle of May to middle of June, right? I would rather look at the season as a whole.
Well, the reason I don't do that is because I don't think that you can just give George Springer a blanket 600 plate appearances anymore. I just don't think you can. So the decision that you are going to have to make, maybe it's mid-May, maybe it's June, but at a certain point, of course, he's playing every day in April. Like, no question about that. But the subtext of what I'm saying there is, like, if he has a 570 OPS on May the 30th, he's got to be a part-time player for you. Like, he cannot be getting every day at bats at that point, in my opinion.
How many, say you play seven games in the week, how many games out of the week would part-time be for you?
Maybe it's he's facing, you know, three starts a week. I don't know.
That would be a dramatic reduction. I could see going from six to five or four and a half, but going down to three would be a really, really dramatic reduction in his playing time.
Yeah. I think that if he's 35 years old and he's got a, you know, in this scenario that I'm lining up, if he has a 570 OPS after 2 months and he's 35 years old, you're trying to win a division here. You're trying to get into the wild card. Like, of course, there are lots of things that are going to go into this: swing decisions and swing planes and swing velocities. And there's going to be data that backs all this up. No one's just doing this on a whim. But if he is not really performing after a couple of months, then it does become decision time, just as it did with, you know, a Justin Turner or Daniel Vogelbach or any veteran player. Sometimes the answer is yes. Sometimes the answer is no. But you don't get, at 35 years old, I just don't think that George Springer gets a blanket 600 plate appearances, which is kind of why I framed the question to you in a smaller scale.
Do you think that the Blue Jays can be successful this season without George Springer being an above average everyday hitter?
Yes, absolutely.
And the pathway to that would be calling somebody up from the minors, whether it's Alan Rodon or Joey Loperfido or whoever, and they fill in with that production.
Yeah, I mean, I think that outfield in particular is probably the area that the Blue Jays have the most major league ready depth. And so if, you know, Anthony Santander sprains an ankle, if George Springer doesn't perform, the Blue Jays, in my opinion, can, Dalton Varsho, we're seeing him sidelined, they're still going to be okay. Like, outfield is actually the one place in this organization where I actually think they have enough depth to withstand injuries or underperformance.
I do think that, like, on the position player side, the Blue Jays are pretty decently positioned, like, as well positioned this year as I think I've seen them.
Yes.
When you're getting down to, like, figuring out the bench and you're like, oh wow, like, maybe we can't fit Addison Barger in here. And, like, Addison Barger is a guy who hits the ball, like, really, really hard and can, for as big as his swing is, make some really impressive adjustments at the plate in terms of, like, just watching him
battle against Aaron Nola on Monday in Clearwater, and like nothing Nola throws is straight, and just, you know, he throws a bunch of different pitches, and he's just like as experienced and capable and cerebral of a pitcher as you're going to find in this league. And like Barger was making contact with a bunch of different pitches, and he hit one that was for sure a homer, for sure fair, and it just got caught up in the wind like beyond the wall, and the umpire made an atrocious decision and said that it had actually gone foul, but it was like 1,000% he homered off Aaron Nola, and he's still able to come back and foul a couple different pitches off and make contact with, I think, a changeup in the end and hit an opposite field single at like 109, if I'm remembering correctly. So like I just think that like Addison Barger is a very impressive hitter, and I really do think there is something there with him. But you're like in a position where you're like, I'm not sure if I can have this guy on our opening day roster, because we have other options that we feel really good about. So, and even beyond them, like you said, with a Roden taking the steps that he has, with a look like Stuart Baroa can like give you a decent plate appearance, man. He can work walk. We saw him take Orion Kierkegaard like 410 feet to center the other day.
Baroa hits it in the air to center, going back. Still tracking back at the warning track. See you later. Stuart Baroa with a blast, and the Blue Jays have their...
Jonathan Class A has like massive tools. Nathan Lucas is a big leaguer. Like, he just is a big leaguer. On a lot of teams, he is a big leaguer. And with this team, he might be up and down. So this is a really long-winded way of saying Leo Jimenez is like... On the Marlins, he's Otto Lopez. He's playing every day. You know, the long-winded way of saying, like, I'm actually think the Blue Jays have really sound position player depth this year.
So you agree with me that they could withstand if George Springer doesn't produce? Like, it's fine. This team isn't built around George Springer anymore. Like, 2021 is a long time ago now.
I think it would be a very complicated decision. There's a lot of variables there.
Oh,
in terms
no doubt.
Of his stature and his salary.
No doubt. I agree with that. And he, you know, there's, it wouldn't be done recklessly, and it shouldn't be done recklessly. But if something benign happened, like he just, I don't know, he cuts his hand and it's fine, but he can't play. Like, they could withstand that is my point. I do think they have the depth. And when you do have that depth, you don't want to let someone continue to get too many reps. I think, you know, just to be super clear, of course, George Springer should start the season. Of course, they should give him every chance. He has a long track record. He had some pretty good stretches toward the end of last season. You start and you see what you can get from him. But I just think you watch that one carefully.
I appreciate you dragging me back into this as I was like desperately trying to deflect and sort of process through it in my head, because I haven't thought that deeply about it. I look at his projections for this year. Zips has him at a 105 WRC plus. Steamer has him at a 111. If he's somewhere in the middle there, 107, 108, over the course of a season, like, I think he's an everyday player for you.
Yeah, that's right. I agree. And we can leave it there because I know you have clubhouse availability to get to. You have a game to get to. Lots happening in Dunedin, in Clearwater, in Sarasota. So we will look for your coverage from Florida as spring training continues. We look forward to more of that and more At the Letters coming up, presented, of course, by MLB The Show 25. With that being said, we'll step away for this week. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to our producers, Christian Ryan and Nick Andrade. For Arden Swelling, I'm Ben Nicholson-Smith. Thank you so much for listening.